welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today, a little later in the show, we're going to take an in-depth look into Donald Trump's Supreme Court pick and also talk a little bit more about the atmospherics and the politics around that, confirmation hearings, and many of the other things that are taking place in the political, social, and economic world that is around us. But before we can move on, the day-long hostage standoff at James T. Vaughn Correctional Center in Smyrna, Delaware, ended early this morning with one dead correctional guard. The uprising caught the country by surprise and rare national news for one of America's smallest states. Prisoners in several phone calls to a local television station stated that the motivation for their action was political and that it was in response to the election of Donald Trump and demanding better conditions in the prison. Prisoners said their number one priority was access to education. They also stated they wanted better health care in prison, more programs to promote rehabilitation and transparency into how the money is spent in the prison to make sure money for these things isn't being diverted, which also comports with the complaint from prisoners about poor administration in general. They also spoke to the issue of serious overcrowding. And all this isn't terribly surprising. As we have seen in a wave of prison uprisings since 2008, conditions in prison in America are often terrible. In states like Alabama, there are some prisons that are well over 200% beyond their required capacity. A few years back, the head of the Federal Bureau of Prisons testified before Congress that overcrowding was so bad in the federal system that it was endangering lives. California several years ago had prisons so overcrowded, the federal courts ruled they actually were violating the Eighth Amendment protections against cruel and unusual punishment. Prisons have significantly cut back educational programs, and it wasn't until last year that prisoners regained in a highly limited fashion a pilot program. In fact, the right to access Pell Grants for college courses that was taken away by President Bill Clinton, believe it or not. Healthcare in prisons is utterly abysmal. Really, we would be here all day dealing with this topic alone if we wanted to give it proper coverage. In the last year, we've learned that both Pennsylvania and Tennessee have policies that deliberately hold prisoners with hepatitis C and conditions that lead to these diseases going inappropriately treated and, of course, them getting very, very sick. In 2002, a federal judge ruled that the Fulton County Jail in Atlanta had to make massive changes to the healthcare system at the jail after there were 23 HIV-positive detainees that died in the jail over the 2 years prior to the lawsuit being filed. Also in 2002, a federal judge ruled that the Tutwiler Women's Prison in Alabama was unconstitutionally unsafe because of terrible health care and overcrowding. The Southern Center for Human Rights, which often files lawsuits in defense of prisoners' rights, notes that, quote, every week they receive a letter or call from a person who has been assaulted, stabbed, or raped in a prison or jail. Sometimes the violent incident has been perpetrated by a fellow prisoner. Other times the abuse is at the hands of officers, end quote. Then they go on to note that too often, those are their words, too often, prison administrators tolerate this sort of thing, this violence and abuse. So in general, the exact reality that the Delaware prisoners are saying that they were rising up against essentially is par for the course in prisons around the country and has been confirmed to some degree by ex-prisoners from that correctional facility in Delaware who spoke to the media during the standoff. This is the first prison uprising to take the life of a guard in some time. This should be a warning flare to the nation that the human rights situation in American prisons is deplorable, often unlawful, and almost completely ignored. It shouldn't take a hostage situation to get people talking about improving prisons. Trump pledged at the National Prayer Breakfast this morning, organized by the extremely secretive but extremely powerful Christian group, The Family, that he would repeal the Johnson Amendment, which prevents churches from engaging in political speech. So in other words, Trump will make it very easy for religious conservatives to wield the massive financial wealth they obtain from the faithful to directly intervene in politics. While people may point out that this seems to be primarily about, you know, campaigning from the pulpit, donations are also considered a form of speech, and the understanding of that is becoming more and more elastic as time goes on. So repealing the Johnson Amendment is giving a green light for churches to not only proselytize in favor of candidates, but to become heavily engaged at the financial end very directly in politics. massive institutions like the Mormon Church, the Catholic Church, the large right-wing evangelical Christian community have been coordinating more and more. In 2009, a gathering of these leaders signed something called the Manhattan Declaration that essentially was a manifesto to work together to push their right-wing Christian views on the rest of America. Mike Pence, the vice president, is also a key figure in this broader community, and his ascension to the White House, many feared, would mean theocratic views could hold sway. Those fears, rather, appear to be coming true. You put all this together, Trump just nominated a Supreme Court justice who believes corporations should be able to impose their religious beliefs on all employees, that freedom from religion may be the most important right anyone has. His vice president is such a religious zealot, he tried to jail a woman for having an abortion. His top advisor, Steve Bannon, promoted a traditionalist Christian-based far-right ideology, and now he wants to give churches the right to intervene directly into the political arena. It was not surprising he was backed so heavily by evangelicals now because he is delivering. While he rails against Islam, Trump is actually empowering Christian theocrats here in the United States who want to force the entire society to conform to their minority views on same-sex marriage, divorce, contraception, and the rights of religions in general. Last night, Milo Yiannopoulos, hopefully that was right, the public speaker and senior editor for Breitbart News, had to be evacuated from the UC Berkeley campus after hundreds, maybe thousands of protesters emerged on the campus to protest his appearance there. Police on campus felt it was too dangerous for him to appear, given the crowd, which at one point started a large fire. Milo more or less makes his living off of this kind of thing. He calls himself a free speech fundamentalist and goes out of his way to say shockingly offensive things, which he somehow views as some sort of vindication of the right to free speech. Many people, rightfully, view him as a rank bigot who delights in using the First Amendment as cover for his hatred. Of course, he and many other civil liberties advocates have claimed that the students were blocking his right to free speech. This is, in fact, not true. It was the university, not the students, who canceled his appearance. Undoubtedly, the police could have found some secure venue for him. They just chose not to, probably because they were also looking for an excuse to get such an offensive personality out of there. From my perspective, he could say whatever he wants, and people have the right to protest him. If the protest becomes so big and so spirited campus police cancel it, that's on them. It isn't stopping anyone's First Amendment speech rights to protest them. It isn't really against their free speech rights to disrupt their speech. There's no right to not be interrupted. There's no right to not draw opposition. If you know you're bound to draw protests, it's on you and the police to prevent people from stopping you. Either way, pretty funny that someone who calls leftists snowflakes for being too sensitive and was too scared in the end to appear at an event just because some people were outside, and then took to Facebook to give a long, whining explanation for why he appeared to show up. I guess Milo, whose tour is called Dangerous F-Word, isn't feeling too dangerous now. Oh, and by the way, someone knocked out a Nazi at this demonstration. There's a photo you can see on Twitter there of a cold-cocked neo-Nazi individual on the ground who tried to go into the crowd saying negative things about Mexicans. So there you go. Berkeley, it's lit. And those were today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined in studio to continue our conversation with Garland Nixon, host of News Views with Garland Nixon on WPFW 89.3 FM here in Washington, D.C., and online at WPFWFM.org around the world. Garland, thank you so much for joining the show.
Hey, well, thank you for having me. I always enjoy coming on.
Pleasure is all mine. I want to start here with the, I guess, still to some degree, banner news of the day, although with Trump, there's always so much news. That's the Supreme Court nomination. What were some of your initial thoughts seeing the nomination of Judge Gorsuch?
Well, you know, I figured that's the type of nominee we would have based on the people that have been, you know, that Trump has surrounded himself with so far. We could expect somebody fairly extreme. You know, to be honest, I expected somebody even more extreme. But, you know, this is your garden variety conservative, far right winger. The only thing I'd say, here are my thoughts on the Supreme Court. I think that the term that I've seen often is it's a stolen seat. In my belief, the Democrats have to do everything they can to filibuster. And if the Republicans are going to kill the filibuster, make them do it. But the Democrats have to do everything they can to stop it, because the seat came open a year before Barack Obama's presidency was up. And the Republicans said, well, here's what we're going to do. When we're out of power, we're going to decide who the Supreme Court justice is. And when we're in power, we're going to decide who the Supreme Court justice is. If there's a Democratic president, well, then we'll just go ahead and put it on hold until we get back in office. So we'll always make the decision. I think the Democrats cannot allow the Republicans. I mean, what difference would it make if Obama had 3 years and 364 and a half days? They would have done that. It was clear they would have done the same thing. And I think the Democrats simply have to say, you cannot hold the Supreme Court seats hostage until you regain power again, however long that's going to be. And I think they have to do everything they can to stop it. If the Republicans are going to use the nuclear option, they got to force them to do it.
No, I think that's a great point. I think the question is what are the odds that they will do it? I mean, already within like seconds of Gorsuch being nominated, you had Joe Manchin and Richard Blumenthal come out and say, oh yeah, definitely we should have hearings and whatever and go through the normal process. I think I saw this morning as many as 7 Democrats had said they were open to that. I mean, almost before a shot was fired, almost enough surrendered to hand the thing over to them.
Well, I think a couple of things. Number one, Chuck Schumer has come out and said, no, we've got to do everything we can to stop it. I think, you know, if you look at what's been going on, the Democrat, Michael Moore came out and said, you know, if they don't, you know, if they don't do that, then we've got to go after the Democrats. We have to primary the people. I think they're recognizing the level of anger that there is at the in the Democratic base, finally. Imagine that, the Democrats actually listening to their base. But, you know, if only for their own, you know, selfish means to keep their seats. But I think they're hearing it, and I think they're recognizing, you know, if we allow the Republicans, if we don't stand our ground in the same way that the Republicans did, there's going to be a very, very dear price for us to pay. And if they don't, they're going to find out, because the Democratic base is absolutely enraged in a way that I've never seen it before.
No, I certainly agree with that for sure. I thought Ryan Grimm from Huffington Post had a great headline last night when they were coming out saying we're going to oppose Gorsuch. And he says, after they tried almost everything else, Democrats are listening to their voters. So good headline
right
there. But, you know, one other thing that sort of struck me about this that I feel like is sort of an underplayed theme. It was a bigger theme in the campaign about what role Mike Pence would play in there. But, I mean, now you have Gorsuch, who in his book about euthanasia is, you know, looking at this, drawing from these sort of traditional conservative beliefs. You have Pence, you have Bannon, sort of same sort of period here, or same sort of ideas here in terms of where they're coming from. I mean, there is really sort of, I mean, to a degree, perhaps even somewhat greater than what we saw in the Bush administration, where like he was a born again Christian, but most of the rest of them were just like godless neocons, where now it's like the sort of theocrats are really on the inside, not just sort of electoral bunting as they normally are for Republicans.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there. And I've been saying for a while, this party is definitely to the right. When Bush came in there, you know, there was a period of time where they had the House, the Senate, and the White House. But the people they have now are definitely to the right of the group that they had in then. And the reason is because of redistricting. The gerrymandering has created these extremely red districts. And by extremely red, I mean extremely conservative to the point where they're not even really conservative. You know, you could call them maybe, you know, extreme. You could call them reactionary probably more than anything else. So the party, I think more than anything else, in their 2010 redistricting, they dragged their party to the right. They won the House doing it, and they can hold on to the House, but they created these districts that are so red that they're extreme. And now, yeah, of course, they're far to the right, because these are way different districts than where they are under the Bush administration in the House. And if you look at it, if you look at the House, I mean, the Senate, the right is the House is definitely to the right of the Senate, and that's the redistricting.
Mm-hmm. No, well, I think certainly, obviously, Democrats have sort of targeted this. I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, they put Eric Holder in charge of this commission to, like, you know, go for the redistricting, which, I mean, like, obviously, you know, late in the game. Although I will say, to their credit, Wisconsin now has that court case where the redistricting there has been ruled illegal for gerrymandering around racial grounds, which could sort of supercharge their effort. But it just sort of seems like the Democratic establishment, I mean, they keep sort of wanting to appeal to their own base, but there's just no real votes of confidence. So you take the attorney general who failed to prosecute any of the Wall Street banks, who told the DEA to stand down in terms of of investigating pharmaceutical companies when they were looking into the opioid epidemic in 2013. And then somehow you say, like, yeah, this is the guy who we feel super strongly to put in charge of, like, taking on this major, huge issue and what will honestly be a tooth and nail fight from Republicans. I mean, it just seems like another situation where they're underplaying the depth of the problem.
Right. And the other point that comes out from what you're saying, which is very important, and that is the anti-Trump movement, because there are two different, very, very different elements on the left of anti-Trump people. One of them is, you know, the anti-Trump in service to the status quo. These are the people who were happy to march, to have the Women's March and put Debbie Wasserman Schultz up there to speak at the Women's March. And, you know, they had the I'm still with her signs. So you still have the Hillary people, the right wing of the Democratic Party, who are still anti-Trump in service to the status quo, in service to the neocons. And if given the opportunity, they dash the pro-corporate party, who basically, so there's two words I think that are important when you understand the two different elements of resistance against Trump on the left. One of them is resistance. Resistance is the right wing of the Democratic Party. That's a word that says, that's a word that Republicans, that conservatives use. What do? You resist change. You want things to be like they are. What did Bernie say? Bernie used the word revolution. The people on the left want a revolution. They want things to change. The progressives want a revolution. They ain't into just resistance. Oh, okay, we can change a few things. We can stop Trump and have the status quo. That's the Hillary, Debbie Wasserman Schultz people. And that's where all this resistance stuff is coming from. And I oppose resistance. I ain't about resisting things just to keep things, keep what we have. And as you said, to keep going with a bunch of corporate Democrats to steer the party right back to the center right and put us right back where we were before.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as you well remember, that's more or less exactly what happened in the Bush era, is that Nancy Pelosi and these other people were pretending to be like so far to the left, and then they win the Congress back. And I'll never forget it. Charlie Rangel, he became head chair of Ways and Means. The first thing he put out in terms of a press release was like, we are not going to raise taxes really high on rich people. Like, so the one thing that most people thought they were going to do, and the other one was impeach Bush, and John Conyers gets in there, and the first thing he says is, oh, well, I'm definitely under no circumstances going to impeach Bush. Then they get Obama, then they get in there, and we all sort of know the story and the way that played out in those first couple years. They didn't really accomplish all that much there in this situation, and it seems like, you know, we're sort of setting ourselves up here. Well, I don't know if we're setting ourselves up. I think that some people are setting themselves up for sort of a replay of that. But we're going to get into all of that here as we come back after this next break. We have Garland Nixon, host of News Views with Garland Nixon on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., here with us on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik, also in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we are continuing our conversation around some of what's been happening in the Senate, some of what could be happening as it concerns the Supreme Court nomination, what this all can mean for both major parties. And who knows, we might get to some other things happening in our world today. And we continue to be joined by Garland Nixon, the host of News Views with Garland Nixon. And, you know, Garland, one of the things I think is relevant to what we were sort of alluding to here in terms of the role of at least in the Democrats, the establishment, that's fallen under the radar now is the DNC race. But big news yesterday, Joe Biden endorsed Tom Perez, and the reports were that Perez then now pulled ahead of Keith Ellison. What do you make of Biden putting his thumb on the scale like this?
It doesn't surprise me. I mean, so they see now, the basically the mainstream of the party, the big money donors, the people in charge are looking at it, and they recognize that it could be slipping away from them, and they've got to do everything they can to try to get their guy. I mean, Perez was in Biden's administration. So they're doing everything they can. We know Obama said that he wanted Perez. We know Perez was a pro-TPP guy, so we know he's from the corporate wing of the party. He's, you know, we've got two people, one of them saying, you know, and Keith Ellison, the two probably leading contenders. And we've got Ellison saying, you know, we don't want the corporate lobbying money anymore. And we've got Perez saying, woo, not so fast there. So, you know, it shouldn't surprise you that a person who has been part of, you know, the corporate power wing of the party in a Joe Biden would go for the corporate. That simply tells you that's who the corporate wing wants.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure. Well, I mean, it just seems to me that that's I mean, it's so clear that if Perez was to win, I mean, it almost seems like it would be more damaging than helpful to them.
Yeah, but they don't learn anything. We got people running around right now, you know, and I see it all the time. We've got people, basically the corporate wing of the party did what they always did. You know, they did what they do so well. They did what they did with Gore. They did what they did with Kerry. You know, what they do very, very well, you know, is lose. And they did it again. And they've never learned anything. If they didn't learn with Gore and Lieberman, with Kerry, and now they come with Hillary and Kane, and afterwards they don't say, well, maybe we're going a little too far to the right and we're alienating our base. No, they never learn. It's not what they do. Mm. They just generally, it's like a person who yells at you and they don't get what you want. And they always say, well, the problem is I'm not yelling loud enough. They never stop to think we shouldn't yell. So they're like, the problem is we didn't go far enough to the right. We are not conservative enough. If we could go a little bit more conservative and pick up those Reagan Democrats that Chris Matthews is always talking about, why, this time it'll surely work.
Mm. Well, you know, one thing I'm sort of trying to figure out here, so it looks like Betsy DeVos may, I mean, she probably will win, but it looks like it may come down to Mike Pence, and who knows, she could potentially lose in terms of this. She may be the first person to really, like, not win on the vote here. But nevertheless, you know, whatever, fine. They moved against her. They did all this, but I mean, I'm trying to pick apart their strategy here because, you know, whatever. It seems like it just Sessions of all of them. Like, DeVos, fine, go against her. I get it. Most of them, I understand, like, some of them, why they're focusing on them. But I can't figure out how the one person that was nominated who had previously been rejected in a Senate nomination for being too racist, whose record did not improve on this issue between the nomination and the time he entered into the Senate. I mean, it's just nonsensical to me that there wasn't the same level of opposition when allegedly this is supposed to be one of the issues that Democrats differentiate themselves so heavily from the Republicans for is quote unquote racism. And yet they seem to be willing to put the least effort into what I kind of thought was like some low hanging fruit there with Senator Sessions.
Well, here's your first mistake. You're looking for a strategy. I've been looking for a strategy in the Democratic Party for like 40 years now, and I have yet to pick one up, you know, so good luck. If you find a strategy there, you know, I see tactics, a lot of tactics, but I never see a coherent strategy that you could apply those tactics to. But the long and short of it is, I think that right now, after the funny thing is, after the election, I think the Democratic Party as a party is kind of in flux. I don't think they're really have their thoughts collected well enough. I don't think they don't even know what the heck happened to them. They're not even sure how they lost. Some of them would argue that they didn't lose, that it was stolen from them by the Russians. So the fact of the matter is, I think they're flying by the seat of their pants. They're trying to learn the new dynamics of politics of Washington. We've seen some of the, like Sheldon Whitehouse the other day. So he voted for Paiello or Patello or whatever the CIA nominee's name was. He comes home. There's like thousands of people in front of his office protesting, and he didn't see that coming. You know, the same with Cory Booker with the pharmaceutical. So they're just starting to learn that their base isn't quite happy with the things that they're doing and that their base is willing to protest. And, you know, good luck figuring this out. I think they're learning a little bit at a time. They don't even know. They're starting to realize they can't do what they always did, which was talk a good game and then fly under the radar while they stab us in the back and give everything away to the Republicans and the corporations. They're just starting to pick up that they can't get away with that like they used to.
I really think that you're right there. I think that sort of the whole lack of strategy can be encapsulated by that that little open mic moment that Nancy Pelosi had in front of the Supreme Court at the rally, where she's like, let's do the real people now. Let's introduce the real people. Where are the real people? And I just thought, like, wow, like, I mean, I guess to some degree, right. I mean, yes, where are the real people? Obviously, that's not them. But, man, like, you got to be pretty – You've reached, I think, the highest level of being out of touch when you were just like 100% in touch with the fact that you were out of touch and not like a real person like the rest of people. But if that's kind of like if that's the essence of your rally, is it you, your staffers, and then you're sort of like casting around trying to grab someone walking by on First Street to speak or say something relevant about the Supreme Court? I mean, you're in trouble. You're in trouble. I think it should be pretty easy.
Remember Nancy Pelosi immediately after she, you know, won her seat back as minority leader or whatever in the House, and she says, I don't think the Democratic base wants change.
Right.
Really?
No one wanted change. No one wanted change. No. Nothing was out there. Well, let me switch gears here. I got to ask you what your thoughts were about this Australia phone call, the other big news. I mean, I don't even know what to say. I mean, what an unbelievable way to deal with something like this. And also, if the AP reports are true with the Mexico call, also a little bit off the chain. Some of these other calls allegedly have been a little bit rocky as well. But the Australia one, of course, I think caught a lot of people off guard, including, I think, all Australians. I mean, what is your reaction to the way Trump seems to be handling these like person-to-person relationships with world leaders?
Yeah, I think here's what I think. I think people, you know, that are learning that everything they feared about Donald Trump is true, that he is grossly incompetent and unprepared for any office, much less the president of the United States. And so what's going to happen now? As a result, you know, what he's doing now, I mean, it only took two or three phone calls for people to recognize that their worst fears were true, that he's incompetent and that he is not a rational party for people to deal with, which means for the next 4 years, if people don't view him as a rational actor, they will not view the United States as a rational actor, as a state, as a country. So basically, and I hesitate to say this, but to some extent, maybe it's good. People, the rest of the world won't be like, well, what does the United States think? Well, how do we react to the United States? Well, we better ask them first. Now they'll go on about their merry way. They'll make decisions, recognizing that the United States is not to be leaned on or trusted. And to some extent, I think that's a good thing. To some extent, I think the United States influence worldwide should be less than it is. So my opinion is, you know, bully for the rest of the people, nations out here that are going to be thinking for themselves a little bit more. The other thing is, I think, you know, Trump's mean to everybody. He's going to threaten everybody. If you're threatening everybody in the world, if you're threatening all the other countries in the world, then the fact of the matter is nobody's going to be scared at you because you can't, like, retaliate against everybody.
Mm. Well, you know, I think that's a good point. And you know, during the campaign, you were raising this to a large degree that sort of the Hillary Clinton people were sort of the quote-unquote Scoop Jackson-style Democrats, for people who don't remember Scoop Jackson, Henry Jackson, hardcore cold warrior, conservative guy. And I mean, I thought about that again today when the whole thing sort of briefly became big and then small over the U.S.-Russia sanctions when there was some little small technical change that was actually about protecting U.S. companies. Everyone was like, oh, my God, Trump is reducing the sanctions on Russia, which was crazy to me on two fronts. I mean, one, Obama campaigned in two separate elections on reducing tensions. And even after he put in the sanctions, as people will remember, you know, he was heavily criticized by neocons for not wanting to turn the Ukraine situation into World War III. People were saying he's super weak, but he held the line there. So, I mean, even in the moments where he pushed back a little bit, he was trying to maintain some level of sanity. At least that's what it appeared. And now it's like the slightest change or even intimation that there may be one means that it's so treasonous. And it seems to speak so heavily to the point you were making about a lot of the sort of campaign team and folks supporting Hillary from that world, that this it really inside the Democrat, there's a big section of people and Republicans, too, no doubt about that. But we knew about that, that sort of confrontation with Russia above and beyond just bellicosity in general is like a key piece of their worldview.
Exactly. A very good point. And the thing about it is, that, you know, as you were saying, it really demonstrates the fracture in the Democratic Party, because we've got the neocons and their ilk who simply use the fact that they, you know, that they rigged the primary as another excuse to, you know, reignite the Cold War. And you've got a bunch of progressives who are saying, look, first of all, we are pro-peace. And if it's Donald Trump, if it's Donald Duck, we don't care who's in charge. Anyone that's doing something that's going to lessen the probability of a military conflict, we're all for that. We'll protest them on everything else. And again, it reflects the issues that we had with Hillary Clinton. And even now, you know, personally, when some people say, well, Garland, aren't you glad? Aren't you sorry now that you didn't vote for Hillary? Because as I told you, I wrote in the ghost of Abraham Lincoln. I was not voting for Hillary. But I even now say no, because for all of the things that I don't like about Donald Trump, which is pretty much all of the things about Donald Trump, the one thing I can say is this. I felt that if Hillary became president, that the possibility of thermonuclear war was dramatically increased. And I can deal with a lot of discrimination and racism and things like that as long as I have not been incinerated at like 3,500 degrees. So even now, I say, would I take Hillary over Trump? Nah, I ain't much on thermonuclear war. I'd rather be out here protesting here rather than, you know, going up in a fireball because she's provoking nuclear war.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was honestly one of the most underplayed parts of – I don't know if it was underplayed, but I felt like people weren't giving enough attention to who these people were in foreign policy who were advising her, who were like the right in the Bush administration in terms of interventionism. I mean, people who were selling donations to her on the basis of her being far more aggressive and interventionist than Barack Obama, who wasn't exactly like the non-interventionist president. So, I mean, things that are certainly quite – you know, quite worrisome at the very least, but, you know, nevertheless, we shall see. And I mean, it is one of those things too, though, where I often find, you know, you connect it to the phone call piece. It's another thing about Trump is just the unpredictability internationally, I think, is interesting. I mean, it doesn't seem like he has any particular sort of world view on how these kind of things work, which is a little bit different than what normally happens inside of Congress and inside of the White House on foreign policy. So it seems like in some ways, I mean, we could be up for a lot of different big upheavals around the world because it doesn't seem like he's going to approach with any sort of consistency foreign policy-wise any part of the world.
Right. But one thing we can say about Trump, based on what we've seen so far, based on everything that we've seen from him, it does not appear that he is a neocon. You know, it appears that he's the old-fashioned kind of authoritarian isolationist, which tends to, you know, old-fashioned authoritarian, which tends to be isolationist. You know, that kind of comes with that right-wing nationalism. And, you know, some, like, you take some countries that right-wing nationalism, you know, kind of manifests itself in, you know, being pro-war, where with some of the others, it manifests itself in kind of turning things inward and being an isolationist. And he tends to be an isolationist, which I'd prefer over someone who's going to go out and try to provoke war. I had a big problem with Hillary, and that's, you know, even now, that's why the Democratic Party is still, you know, they think they've united, but the Democratic Party has not united. And actually, I think the Republican Party, it's funny, because the Republican Party thinks that they've united around Trump, but there are going to be some policy issues that they're going to fall apart on.
What do you think some of those issues are going to be? What are some of the big fault lines?
Obamacare. They're in a world of deep and serious trouble when it comes to Obamacare, because you've got 20 Republican senators that are from states that accepted Medicaid expansion. Rob Portman up in Ohio, they got 700,000 people. Do you think those people for one second are going to do away with Obamacare and go home knowing that the very next time there's the opportunity for the voters to come to the voting booth, they're sure to lose their seat? So I don't think they're going to have the votes, the Republican votes, to repeal and replace Obamacare, which is what they're claiming they're going to do, much less get the Democratic vote. So how are they going to deal with their base when they can't even do it themselves without the Democrats?
No.
And I think because Trump is not a pure Republican, really, there are going to be some areas where they're going to love him. But I think there's going to be some areas where he's going to run afoul of the establishment. And it's going to be, I don't think we necessarily know where they'll be immediately, but I think there will be some.
No, I think you're 100% right. I mean, even the people inside of his administration, I mean, you've got people with two or three different views on things, so it should be interesting. You know, one other thing, this hostage situation in the Delaware prison yesterday, I mean, I felt like that was sort of a wake-up call in the context of everything that's been happening in Trump's first week. As many of the things I obviously disagree with, I've been talking about them all week. But, you know, for so many people, and we talk about the number of people who didn't vote, this was just a reminder to me of, for so many people, you know, things were already terrible. I mean, so it was just sort of one of those things where you had, we're making America great again, America's already great, and I think that so many people were kind of turned off by both of those slogans, people don't show up, and then you see these prisoners just wanting education, rehabilitation services, and it just reminds you that there's so much out there that is causing so much dissatisfaction that really was just unspoken to for so many years, hence how, you know, volatile our environment has become politically.
And the other thing that reminds us, a couple of things, and that is, number one, of why we have the fractured Democratic Party that we do, because, I mean, the fact of the matter is, why is it that the prisoners can't go to college? It's because of policies of Bill Clinton. Why is it that there's so many people in prison? you can make a very strong argument it was the policies of Bill Clinton. And I'll add this. And the other thing that we don't talk about in America, you know, I guarantee if you ask the average American, is slavery outlawed in America? They'd say, sure, that's the 13th Amendment. Nah, the 13th Amendment, slavery is not outlawed in America. The 13th Amendment says involuntary servitude is prohibited except if duly convicted of a crime. So the fact of the matter is, we still have slavery in America. That's something we don't talk about much, but slavery is not outlawed in America. That's why that all of these states, particularly a lot of southern ones, take these prisoners and they send them out and for the corporations, and they're actually out there building stuff for like six cents an hour or something because they're actually slaves.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's in some of these states, you know, and also in the federal government, they require the state governments and the federal government to buy a lot of this stuff from these prison people to make sure that they have these like viable industries. I mean, it really is an unbelievable thing on so many different levels. And certainly that is exactly what a lot of these prisoners were pointing us to there in Delaware. And it's just unbelievable that it takes something like this to wake people up. But it seems like that's going to also be like another big issue and where politics goes in this country. About a minute left. What happens with the people who don't vote? Do they become active or do they not become active?
It's a good question. I think it all depends on what happens with the two parties. You know, initially, you would think it would be easy to get people to vote in 2018 if the Democratic Party has any sense. It will be, but if they continue to run to the right, if they continue to be a shiesty, crooked party when it comes to intra-party politics, they could still have problems. They are not out of the woods.
Yeah, no, I think so for sure. I mean, it seems like they aren't even able to mobilize their own base that significantly in off-year elections anyway. I mean, that certainly, as many people remember, was always Barack Obama's big thing, was that, oh, you show up and you vote for me, but you don't show up and vote for anybody else, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, in and of itself, this has always been one of the big weak points of Democrats, has been this issue of people, oftentimes many people, a huge chunk of their voters will turn out on a presidential year and just won't turn out in a non-presidential year. But we're going to have to leave it there. We're going to come back after this break with a final segment. Thanks to Garland Nixon for joining us here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch, and what this could mean for, I guess, all of us, since the Supreme Court affects just about everything we do in some way, shape, or form. And we are joined for this conversation by Jessica Piccolo, the Vice President, Law and Courts at Rewired.News. Jessica, thank you for being with us again.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So I wanted to start here, sort of a supple pick here by Donald Trump. I mean, it almost seems sort of like he tried to pick a right-wing version of a Merrick Garland type of move here, someone who, you know, hits the points that the right wing, you know, wants to be seen hitting, I guess, if that's what you're doing, but also someone who has sort of wide respect in the legal profession that, you know, perhaps will be able to slide through here. Your thoughts?
Absolutely. Neil Gorsuch is both a frontline soldier in the culture wars and has been his entire career and even as his time as a law student. But he is also one of those jurists, very much like Chief Justice John Roberts, whose very right-wing conservatism is wrapped up in the sense of pedigree and professionalism and norms and traditions that exist within the legal community. So that the idea that within the legal community there is a broad diversity of opinions, there is, somehow that gets wrapped up in, well, it doesn't matter that, you know, when he was a student, he was president of a club called Fascism Forever, which has been reported. It's that he's a really nice guy and a very smart judge. And Gorsuch is a very smart judge. I mean, his opinion, as a judge on the Federal Court of Appeals in Hobby Lobby was largely adopted by the Supreme Court. And that is what has more or less created the idea of corporations having the ability to launch religious objections to laws they don't agree with.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's a good point. And, you know, I don't know how closely you've been following all the other sort of commentators talking about this, but I thought Noah Feldman at Bloomberg View had an interesting piece about Gorsuch a little bit before he was picked, and this sort of everyone sort of bandying about, oh, he's an originalist and he's like Scalia. And Feldman was like, but you know, if you read his book about euthanasia, it's not like super originalist. It's certainly very conservative, but it's really almost more like traditional Christian conservative. Long story short, it actually reminded me reading that piece and taking a quick look at the book of Steve Bannon more so than any other sort of contemporary figure in terms of like the root of the piece. And I thought, well, you know, as terrible as Scalia was, this seems like this could actually be worse given sort of what we know about the roots of this kind of conservatism.
Absolutely. And it's been reported that Gorsuch was Bannon's top choice. And he's also the choice of Mike Pence, our vice president. And we've seen what Mike Pence has done in terms of the culture wars in the state of Indiana. So this is absolutely ideologically driven. I mean, I will say that Gorsuch is a smart judge. He is an excellent writer. But frankly, Scalia has more ideological integrity, at least earlier in his career. That sort of waned once we got into the government broccoli part of Justice Scalia. But there's a lot to, you know, you can disagree, and I certainly do. But, you know, with Scalia, at least he was honest about where he was coming from.
No, I think that's a good point. And it's also like, you know, when we talk about qualifications, I mean, Carl Schmitt, great legal mind and philosopher, but a Nazi. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, I mean, okay, fine.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, he can write, but oh, what does that mean?
Two things can be true at the same time. You can be an excellent legal thinker and still hold abhorrent ideas that as a society, we have a moral and, you know, as lawyers and government officials, we have a legal and professional responsibility to push back against. I mean, those two things can exist at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, it really is a shocking thing. Well, you know, one thing that I think is interesting, and I know you've written a little about this, and it's something I'm glad you wrote about this because I haven't seen any analysis of this in any of the other pieces on Gorsuch, is, you know, a lot of people I think have been wondering in terms of police use of force, you know, what would happen? And I think a lot of people have felt that one of the big issues is that the sort of governing statutes or precedents, as it were, are like way too broad. I think many people have hoped somehow a police use of force case could come before the Supreme Court. Some of this could be revisited and it could change the game a little bit. So do we know anything about Gorsuch? Well, we do, because I just said you wrote about it. What do we know about him in terms of that type of situation? I mean, who knows if a case like that will come up, but let's just say it did.
Right. Well, so Gorsuch has a pretty consistent record on siding with law enforcement in terms of excessive force cases. Not always, but more often than not, he is willing to find and use liability shields to protect law enforcement in excessive force cases. So that's troubling. What I would say is that he very much falls in line with who is likely our future Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, in this law and order policing type of mentality, which we know has historic and very specific racial dog whistles attached to it. So I think what is important is, in large part, is that we keep connecting these dots and these pieces together, because what it shows is that, you know, we've heard in the first, you know, 2 weeks of the Trump administration that it's been chaos. And in a lot of ways it is, but there's one area that has not been chaotic. There's one area that has had a pretty systemic and specific rollout, and that is the administration's assault on civil rights. And I think that we need to put the nomination of Neil Gorsuch in that same category.
No, I think I really think you're 100% right on that. And I definitely feel that, I mean, it almost seems like it's part of like this, I mean, the whole thing in terms of him coming in here, I think also sort of how we fit it in the broader piece with the nominees and all of that. I mean, I think you referred to it as shock and confusion. I mean, it almost seems as if, like, you know, you've got the Sessions piece, so he seems like, you know, sort of just totally crazy and insane. They got Gorsuch on the other hand, it seems like, oh, maybe they're somewhat reasonable. They got Rex Tillerson, people are like, oh, maybe he's a centrist. And it's like, so people don't connect the dots between all these different pieces and look at the general thrust of what's coming from the administration. They just say like, oh, well, maybe this isn't a bad sign or this is a bad sign, as opposed to that sort of, you know, linking these things.
Well, right. And I think it's really bizarre that we have elected officials who are from the Democratic Party who are voting for these nominees. I mean, if we learned anything from the Republicans during the Obama administration, is that there is no electoral consequence for political obstruction. And if that is the case, then what are these Democrats doing? Like, why are you voting for Elaine Chao? You don't have to. We should be taking a principled stand, and some are not. And the principled stand they believe they are taking is congeniality within their profession. But that is long gone, and the rest of us are paying the price for it with our lives. And so, like, those are the people that I really want to focusing, us being sort of, you know, the left focusing on, because what are they doing? I expect Republicans to fall in line with the Trump administration. To be honest, the Trump administration largely represents the ideology of the Republican Party at this point. But the Democrats are the opposition party, so they need to be acting like it.
No, I hear you. I hear you 100%. Although, you know, the Nancy Pelosi hot mic in front of the Supreme Court when she said, let's introduce the real people now. I guess kudos for having quote unquote real people. But I kind of feel like if you self-referentially have now realized I am not at all a normal, real, average person, you may be too out of touch to lead the thing. But one other issue I want to talk about here, about this. The Chevron deference, and it's becoming my favorite phrase. I almost want to make that like my Twitter name. But I mean, what is it? I feel like it's being thrown around, Chevron deference. I mean, what is this? And, you know, Gorsuch wants to eliminate it. So what are some of the knock-on effects of that?
Okay, so I can say with 100% certainty that when I was a law student, a practicing lawyer, in all of my years in journalism, I never thought I would spend this much time in an area of administrative agency law, which is one of the sort of nerdiest areas of the law, talking about the Chevron doctrine. But here we are in Trump's America. The Chevron doctrine is a line of legal precedent, goes back over 30 years, that says effectively agencies, administrative agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency, for example, has the ability to broadly construe a policy within it that it's set to enforce. And so this is sort of a civics lesson. Agencies are created by Congress. They get basically a charter that says, agency, you are, you know, charged with overseeing and enforcing X part of it. Because Congress can't do everything by itself, right? I mean, it can barely do anything. The executive has to help out. This is sort of how we work together, the idea of checks and balances. And so Congress writes the statute that creates the agency. The agency then, under the Chevron doctrine and other law that pre-exists that, is allowed to do things like create rules for how the laws that it enforces interacts, right? One of the rules, for example, that an agency has crafted is the birth control benefit in the Affordable Care Act. There's a legal process that goes through that. So fast forward a little bit, what Gorsuch and conservatives who oppose the Chevron doctrine, and I will say that this represents a very, 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 very far right wing of judicial thinking, they don't want that kind of power in one part, and they also don't want the court's ability to review it in the second. So what they're arguing for effectively is insular action from the agencies in a very limited fashion that has effectively no judicial review. So creating little mini fiefdoms within the executive branch. We have a word for that. It's not democracy. It's fascism. Mm. And there's really no other way to call it, because that is unaccountable power. And we see that going on. The administration is right now ignoring federal court orders. I mean, attorneys in Virginia late on Wednesday filed a motion for contempt, arguing that the Trump administration was continuing to deport people in violation of the injunction blocking that ban in federal court in Virginia. So, I mean, there's, when we talk about, Eugene connecting the dot. These are the kinds of dots to connect, because who would know or care about Chevron,
right?
I mean, what is this? It is this like weird little corner of the law, but it is really powerful and important. And the idea that the Trump administration has picked for their first Supreme Court a judge who is on record consistently throughout his career saying, I am in favor of creating these unaccountable fiefdoms within the executive branch, and is also in large part the grandfather from a legal perspective of corporate religious refusals, is terrifying.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're right. And you know, you pair that with one other piece that I noticed Demos brought to the attention of the world. I got the email, but that he wants to apply the strict scrutiny review, which if you don't know, it's the highest form of constitutional protection, to the direct donations to candidates. So like if people know about Citizens United, that's basically what they apply to the independent groups to let corporations and whoever give as much money as they want. And it sort of seems that, I mean, this is just my interpretation as a non-lawyer, if you apply that to the individual contributions to candidates, that basically campaign finance law would cease to exist. I mean, there would be no basis to ban anyone from donating as much money as they want if it's the same thing as speech in the same way.
Oh, you are 100% right. And I'm sad to say it gets worse. The Trump administration has said it is on record as wanting to abolish the Johnson Amendment. The Johnson Amendment is the law in place that currently prevents churches from directly preaching from the pulpit.
Wow.
Again, connect the dots. Put all of these pieces together. When we talk about shock and confusion, the idea is that everything is so scattershot, it is impossible to see the forest for the trees. But this is really critical that we do. We get rid of the Johnson Amendment and we apply strict scrutiny to individual donations, as you so very rightly summarized. We have killed not only campaign finance reform, but we have opened the floodgate for direct religious funding of government activities.
Wow.
And there's also a Supreme Court case pending on a very similar issue that isn't scheduled for arguments yet, that would open up the ability of states to use block grant funds from the federal government to go directly to religious institutions too. So this is a thing.
Wow. I mean, that's, it's hard to even know what to say. Well, I want to touch on this too before we go. I mean, I know that some people are sort of saying, well, he hasn't ruled directly on right to life cases, so we don't know what he's going to do on that. I mean, he wrote a book about euthanasia, and the two things kind of go together. He was against it, as people may imagine, and, you know, very strongly for life, as you've already mentioned, and Hobby Lobby, all mm-hmm. those cases. So, I mean, it sort of seems like we can basically guess where he's going to fall on this one. But, I mean, you are out there in the 10th Circuit Court area. I mean, how does it seem to you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, all of those reasons, plus according to the White House press reports, when the decision was made that it was Gorsuch, if folks like the Susan B. Anthony list and the Charlotte Lozier Institute were in the room making that decision, Mike Pence was right there. So there's no reason they would put anybody on the bench who they thought for a second was not squarely on their side in terms of anti-abortion law and intent on overruling Roe and Casey altogether. And I would just add one more little part of it. I would throw in the idea that he's interested in overturning Chevron too, because by saying Chevron should be overturned, that says this is a specific area of legal precedent that I have an ideological opposition to and want to work to overrule. If he doesn't respect Chevron, what makes us think that he respects Roe?
No, that's a very good point. That's a very good point. Only wishful thinking. I mean, it sort of seems like the only way you could possibly say anything about this guy positively, like, oh, he won't be that bad, is just like crazy wishful thinking on so many different, you know, levels. I don't know how. But I guess the other question I have is, I mean, can the Democrats actually stop this? I mean, certainly Trump has come out for the nuclear option.
Yeah.
How's it looking?
Yeah, grim. I mean, I don't know. You know, part of it is that we know the administration will just blow up whatever they need to blow up to get him on the bench. And so, does it matter if it's Gorsuch? Do we have any reason to believe that the next nomination that the Trump administration gets is going to be any better? Or if Democrats block that, you know, then the administration wouldn't go nuclear? It's really, in terms of the federal courts, the Democrats have really painted themselves in a terrible corner right now. I will say the only immediate silver lining is that Gorsuch, if he gets put on the bench, doesn't change the immediate makeup of the bench. It's still a 5-4 conservative bench. And so, yes, Garland's seat was stolen. And I think that, you know, Garland was a milquetoast nominee to begin with, but that was a stolen seat. However, where we are right now, that composition won't change. The hope also is that Kennedy continues to be a centrist. That is shaky place because, for me at least, because Gorsuch was a clerk to Kennedy. So we know that there's at least, again, professional camaraderie between the two. And to the degree that that means that Gorsuch has Kennedy's ear in a different way than Scalia did, you know, I think that that would be something to pay attention to if we're talking a case like Roe, like a Roe challenge.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's certainly a very relevant issue. And obviously, I think they're hoping maybe to push Kennedy out of there sooner rather than later, make him feel that you know, someone like him is on the bench and how it will go. So, I mean, we'll have to see. But, I mean, I guess seeing this nominee, the fact that Trump could even have two more, I mean, that's that seems like quite the proposition. So beyond just like whether he gets through or not, it almost seems like the sort of spirit of the fight is extraordinarily important here for whatever comes next. About 1 minute here till we have to close.
Absolutely. We're talking about potentially undoing hundreds of years of protections and of civil rights, not just one nomination.
Yeah. No, I mean, it really is so much that's at stake here. And I mean, at the court level, at the legislative level, at the executive level, and all the things flowing from those two things and how they work out together. I mean, it really just seems like maybe this is just another many signs here in, I guess, week one, essentially, of the administration of what we have coming. But nevertheless, we are going to have to leave it there for now. Go to rewire.news. Check out all of the stuff that Jessica is doing and writing. It is very important. That is going to do it for today's show. You were listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. See you next time.
By any means necessary.